President Donald Trump must have been awfully busy during the 4 years between his first term and his second. He shot out of the starting gate with an avalanche of executive orders covering everything from energy to immigration to DEI and more. Keeping up with all this, much less making sense of it all, feels kind of like drinking from a fire hydrant. But we're going to take a stab at it today on this episode of Independent Outlook. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And for the task today, I'm joined by two colleagues who actually understand a lot of this stuff. First, I'm so happy to have with us Philip Magnus, holder of the David Thoreau Chair in Political Economy here at Independent. Welcome, Phil.
Happy to be here.
Second, I also get to welcome my longtime conversation partner, William St. Evers, director of our Center on Educational Excellence, who knows a lot about matters beyond education policy as well. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Graham.
Okay, so gentlemen, this is going to be a bit like a relay race as we turn from subject to subject on these executive orders. Maybe we'll analyze seven or eight of them. We're going to start with civil service reform in a moment. But before we do, what do you think about the Wall Street Journal's argument that these executive orders are part of a larger Trump theme about some kind of new American exceptionalism, holding together a coalition of tech moguls and populists? What do you think of that?
I think there's something of an element to it in the sense that Trump views himself as a very strong, assertive executive. He's a president in the model of a heavy-handed executive power style leader, something of an Andrew Jackson mixed with Teddy Roosevelt. And as Trump himself likes to cite, William McKinley thrown in there to the mix. But at the same time, I also see a lot of these executive orders that we saw in the first week or so of his presidency. It's kind of a tit for tat back and forth with Joe Biden, who issued a flurry of executive orders in the final months of his presidency. And you actually look at the list, and quite a few of them are just countermanding the previous set of executive orders. So there is like a seesaw effect going back and forth.
So Wall Street Journal columnist Walter Russell Mead made this argument, and he thought that unskilled labor flowing freely into the country is not that important to high-tech companies. But if they don't have the exceptions for highly skilled engineers and people like that, I believe it's H-1B visas, they're going to be very upset. And you could see that in the exchange between, say, Elon Musk and some of the commentators on Fox News that said, you know, if we allow these visas, we're betraying the populist creed. So Mead thinks that, yes, they're populists both in Europe and in the United States, but the American populists have not been particularly anti-capitalistic. And he points to, as Phil just did, to Andrew Jackson, who was, of course, against the central bank and pro-free trade and so forth. And he argues that there is a possible coalition that could last for a while. But there are other people who have worries. Kim Strassel says, look at all the things, industrial policy, controlling interest rates on credit cards, hiking tariffs, all these things. She points to almost a dozen things that she says, this is really the end of the Reagan, Goldwater, pro-free market Republican Party if this trend continues. Carl Zinsmeister, who years ago ran a fabulous magazine called American Enterprise that and somehow disappeared, I guess was too costly for American Enterprise Institute, but he wrote an interesting column, and it's kind of touching again on this Jacksonian theme. His idea is that both the high-tech people and the populace don't like bureaucracy, don't like arrogant, elitist, ruling class types that think that, you know-it-alls.
Because in the one case, they resent their superiority. In the other case, they resent the obstacle to innovation.
Right. But in practice, maybe that will work together. So he also, Mead is more like commenting on the reality or the possibility of it. And Zinsmeister is applauding it and saying, yes, let's do this. This is really the American system is built actually along these lines. That is his argument.
So we're going to see as we go through some of these things, do these executive orders hang together in some kind of
picking eight or something, so it's harder to do that.
We're going to ask ourselves, do these executive orders facilitate or degrade that potential coalition that we're talking about here? Those are some questions that are in my mind as we proceed anyways. Civil service reform. I've been reading a lot about Schedule F. And according to some people, Schedule F is a terrible thing because it increases the proportion and number of federal employees who are directly appointed by the president, which means they lose their credential, the benefit of their long-term credentials and expertise. They become subject to the political whims of the ruling presidential party. We don't get the expertise we need in the federal bureaucracy. But on the other hand, other people say, but the problem is we're getting a consolidated, coagulated elite, which is all has one point of view. And if we have more Schedule F, then we'd be freer to have the bureaucracy reflect the sentiments of the American people. Which is it, Phil?
Well, this is a tension that goes back to the earliest days of American history, and it's something we used to have called the spoils system. The idea here was to the victor go the spoils. Whoever was elected president could then dole out all sorts of jobs through the federal bureaucracy.
That now, sounds mean.
Challenged. Yeah, it's challenged.
And the politicians that appointed them also extracted monetary rent, so to speak.
Absolutely.
They said, you have to contribute. And they said, and you have to walk precincts, or nowadays you say man phone banks or whatever. But I'll let Phil talk a little more, but I have some additional points.
It guaranteed political loyalists to the current president, but it also made for a lot of turnover. Now, in the late 19th century, a competing theory emerges that says that the bureaucracy needs to be staffed by experts, people that are above the fray of the political cycle. Now, I always considered this a very naive view, but this was Woodrow Wilson's major contribution to political science before his own presidency, was to professionalize the administrative class of the state. And that's where we've had the modern civil service essentially grows out of that movement. But the tension here is always, I think there's a general democratic norm that recognizes, yes, the winner of the election should have people under him or her that are representative of that vote that was cast. And this is the point that Trump keeps making. Yet at the same time, there needs to be some continuity, some stability. And a lot of these agencies have really specialized tasks at hand. So, for example, you wouldn't want an incompetent person appointed to be the head of NASA. You actually want a rocket scientist that knows what they're doing. You wouldn't want just a random poll worker off the street to run the CDC. You want a medical doctor that knows something about that task. But the great tension here, you could also go too far in the other direction, which I think we saw in Anthony Fauci, who really established himself as like a J. Edgar Hoover type figure of the National Institutes of Health, this 40-plus year bureaucrat that maneuvered and manipulated his way through five or six presidencies, attaining power each way. And by the end of his career, he was the highest paid civil servant in the entire federal government and was basically unchallenged and unchallengeable in his exercise of power, which we saw during COVID.
So it seems to me also that, you know, this is not just only in American history. This goes back to the ancient Greeks. I mean, they had the idea of rotation in office. You find it discussed in Aristotle, for example. Madison talked about rotation in office. Andrew Jackson made it a principle. That did not mean he fired everybody. Let's say, I think it's been estimated that he fired 10% and put his own people in. That means not only that your own people are going to follow you, but the other people are going to pay close attention, because if you're willing to fire that 10% and everybody's basically at will, you better shape up and get with the program. Now, public choice theory, it's the kind of political science that makes use of economic analysis, argues that bureaucrats are basically out to do sort of two things or two and a half things. So one is to expand their budgets and the number of people under them that they are bossing around. And the other is to expand their jurisdiction, the extent of their power and authority. Now, the problem is that those incentives run counter to the president's policy getting upheld. So I think it makes more sense to go with President Trump's position than Andrew Jackson's position here. And it means when you have a bureaucracy that's insulated this way, it's hard to say, well, some policy deed happens of some sort. Well, who's responsible? Is it the president and his party, or is it some bureaucrat? The Supreme Court in general has held, and this comes up with the firing of inspectors general, the Supreme Court generally has held that the president is entitled to fire policymaking people in the federal government.
Fire and hire.
Well, certainly fire. So the point is, otherwise it's not really his administration. So I think there's a strong case to be made for the
constitutional, yeah.
There's a constitutional case, there's a public choice case, there's an American democratic tradition case. As far as losing expertise, okay, they should be careful about that. The person at the top can also hire experts.
Right. Well, and there's the case for the confirmation power of the Senate. It's a mechanism, at least at the very top of agencies, to ensure that the person's qualified.
So it sounds like a net thumbs up from both of you on expanding Schedule F.
Unless you agree with the Roman historians who say that we have thumbs up and thumbs down wrong.
That could be. I'm persuaded, too, that it seems like a net gain. I just do wonder, though, whether fired federal employees that, you know, could result from this process might invoke contractual obligations that were undertaken on their behalf and on the government's behalf when they were hired in the civil service process and rules, and whether those contractual obligations will be an obstacle.
I'm sure that's the case. That happens in California when you try to do anything.
It will be litigated.
It will be litigated, but the administration is glad to spend our tax money litigating it.
Right, exactly. So, okay, next subject. So on January 20th, President Trump signed an executive order on birthright citizenship, greatly curtailing it compared to what it has been for a long time. And then 3 days later, U.S. District Judge John Kochanor, he issued a temporary restraining order, and he called Trump's order against birthright citizenship blatantly unconstitutional. Of course, Judge Kochanor did not write those words in his order. That was just his public statement, the part about blatantly unconstitutional. So the thing is supposed to be put on hold for 14 days, but there's a bunch of other suits pending. So here, let me just give you a couple factoids before we plunge in further. Literally, I'm reading from the executive order. It forbids government agencies to issue or accept citizenship documentation for persons when that person's mother was unlawfully present in the United States at the time of birth, and the father was not a United States citizen or lawful permanent resident, or when that person's mother's present in the United States was lawful but temporary, and the person's father was not a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident at the time. So I looked back carefully at my favorite pocket constitution here, which I keep with me all the time. The 14th Amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So here's my thought, and then I'm going to ask you guys, obviously, but I think we should always start out by sticking to the plain wording of the text. In this case, the plain wording of the text makes at least one point clear, that being born on U.S. soil is not the same thing exactly as being subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S., because there are these two distinct phrases. The second phrase is not already entailed in the first. It means something distinct. from the first phrase. In other words, the second phrase about subject to jurisdiction is not just wasted surplus language. So the wording of the text tells us it's possible to be born on U.S. soil, but not be subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. So the whole controversy really is about what is the distinct meaning of the second phrase and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So courts in the Congress have said contradictory things on this. Earlier, they weighed in on one way, and later evidence in recent generations weigh the other. So earlier, at the very beginning, 1866 was the year that the first Civil Rights Act was adopted, and also the year that Congress passed and recommended for ratification the 14th Amendment. The 1866 Civil Rights Act says literally, speaks of all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power are citizens. And so that is, that phraseology seems to be echoed in that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. I saw an interesting quote from Senator Lyman Trumbull of Connecticut, who was a key figure in the adoption of the 14th Amendment, who said that subject to jurisdiction included owing no allegiance to any other country. And then there was the 1872 Slaughterhouse cases, a very pivotal set of cases from the court, which said that the phrase subject to its jurisdiction was intended to exclude from its operation children of ministers, consuls, and citizens or subjects of foreign states born within the United States. So that leans one way, but then there are other court cases that lean the other way. So it seems to me that there is a legitimate dispute here about how to interpret this phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So now let me stop and let you talk about the same thing.
So the first thing is, legally, subject to the jurisdiction thereof doesn't just mean traffic laws and right. murder laws. It means something stronger and higher than that. So the early cases that you cited really mean subject to the allegiance of the person involved. So a tourist from France who has a baby, according to these earlier people, or an ambassador from France, or they are not, or let's say it's a French soldier who's cooperating with the Americans during the Revolutionary War, whatever it is, they are not subject to allegiance to the United States. And so their children would not be automatic American citizens. The problem is one of the main background pieces is there was no federal action on immigration until 1875. So when these people drew up the 14th Amendment in 1866, they didn't have this problem in mind. People were coming and going, and that was that.
Well, not only that,
there's nothing in the Constitution about immigration. The only thing that's there is naturalization,
right?
Which is different from immigration. There is nothing.
Bill?
Not a word about immigration in the Constitution.
Yeah, you go back to the original text of the Constitution, it says natural born citizen, and then there's the process to become a naturalized
citizen. Right.
You're not born in the U.S.
So natural born also can have to do with your parentage and who you had allegiance to. I know this is...
Well, it possibly
complicates Barack Obama, but we won't go there.
Well, it invokes old legal doctrines from the British common law.
That's right.
Which were rooted in, and Britain was distinct in this from most of the other European powers, that birth on the soil of Britain established one as what originally was a subject and then became a citizen of Britain. So insofar as we inherited that.
But Britain had subjects.
Yes.
And so it's really a feudal, you are my liege lord, you know? And so the United States is not feudal. So
yep.
ours so has a somewhat more Lockean notion of allegiance and citizenship and so forth.
Yeah. Well, and it's the presence on the soil. And then you have the legal history, as Bill mentioned. It's not until 1875 we start getting congressional action to restrict immigrants. And the major movements there are to restrict Chinese immigrants who were brought over to work on the railroads. This actually is what breeds the first major court cases to test this doctrine under the 14th Amendment. So 14th Amendment's ratified in 1868, less than a decade later, you have Congress passing Chinese Exclusion Acts and increasingly stringent the restrictions on people from certain countries.
And you'll notice that the Trump order is very careful that if you're a permanent legal resident,
yes,
then if it's okay to be having the baby.
If your parents are, then you're a citizen.
Yes. Yeah. And that's because the Supreme Court case growing out of the Chinese immigrant laborers involved child of permanent legal residents. And so the court held that that child was...
And that case was cited by Judge Kochanore in
Seattle. It's cited by both sides, but, you know, a little loosey-goosey, right?
So. Yeah, well, the point I would make about that case, which is called U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark, is that Wong Kim Ark, he was born in San Francisco. He was taken back to China and then wanted to come back. And they tried to stop him because he was, supposedly wasn't a citizen. But the case held, the holding of the case was that he was a citizen because his parents had what the court called permanent, legally recognized permanent domicile and residence in San Francisco at the time he was born. So in other words, under Trump's order, Wong Kim Ark would be a citizen.
Yes.
Now, the case goes on to talk about common law and a variety of other things and seems to say that anyone born on the soil, regardless of the legal status of their parents, is a citizen. But the literal holding of that case has everything to do with the permanent domicile of his parents.
Well, the great question, the subject to the jurisdiction thereof is the phrase that everything turns on.
Yes.
I think one of the interesting things here, you know, there is a narrow construction of this. This is, it's basically diplomats, people that are here on assignment in the United States, but work for another government. It would be the ambassador from France. It'd be consular officials. It might be military
attaché. It could be a correspondent of the London Times who is a British citizen.
But the great question here, if it's a narrow construction of this, then that's a very small subset of people that if they had children while they lived in the United States as part of this diplomatic purpose that would not qualify as citizens. If it's a broad construction, then it has other implications. And one of those might be, and I think this is something that the Trump administration might be stumbling backward into, do we hold that H-1B visa holders who are here temporarily are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States while they are in residence in the United
because
States.
Because they retain their political allegiance to their home country.
I think they would have to. I think that's the logic of their position. Yeah. So the children of those people would not be citizens.
Because they
become naturalized.
No, until they get permanent legal residence.
Fine. So they get permanent
that's
legal.
Fine.
So,
yeah. that's
so is there a retroactive... And then the other question becomes, if you go down that route, does it effectively mean that an H-1B visa holder has something akin to diplomatic immunity where our only recourse is to turn them over to their home government?
I think the logic of the Trump people's position is the H-1B people are like tourists or something like that, or the London correspondent
for extended visas.
Treated as an extended tourism
present. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course, most countries around the world do not have this birthright citizenship thing. Most countries...
But some do.
Some do, but most will claim that they have jurisdiction over the children of their citizens or subjects, even if the citizens are born out of their own country.
So there's another interesting question. This was Lincoln's attorney general. And he argues, among other things, that there's only two categories, aliens and citizens. So we seem to have inserted since this day some sort of limbo in or intermediate positions. Yeah. Like
foreign subjects or
whatever. Anyway.
And a Lincoln opinion. Yeah.
So
it's fascinating
he is writing mostly in the context of repudiating Dred Scott. He's writing he's writing in 1862. He's writing before the 14th Amendment has been drafted. But he's he's still addressing the question of citizenship. And he's importantly saying that if you're born in the United States, you are a citizen. You are a natural born citizen.
That was Lincoln's position. I think Lincoln was mistaken on that.
And that we're not one, unlike some think tanks who will go unnamed at the present time. We are not abject venerators of Lincoln. He can make.
That's the fascinating twist, because some of the arguments for the Trump position are coming out of persons that are otherwise known for very strict adherence to Lincolnian jurisprudence.
At the time of Lincoln's remark,
not Lincoln's. Later, it's not Lincoln so much as it's his attorney general, this man.
From Lincoln for the explicit purpose.
At that time, and then subsequently around the turn of the century, when it seemed to be becoming more solidified, that it was just simply birth did the trick for you, and subject to the jurisdiction thing got minimized. There was not the kind of massive instant transportation that we have in the modern world. It was not the case that the U.S. borders were being besieged by potentially millions of people who could get here in a snap, or in a relative snap.
The camp of the saints. Anyway, the point is we won't get into that. But the point is, really, the ease of transportation should not affect jurisprudence. I think the real thing that's going on is, over time, some of these terms like natural born, like subject to the jurisdiction thereof, people have lost the original meaning. Now, if you're going to have a jurisprudence of original meaning, which some Supreme Court justices and law clerks and law professors think we're better off doing unless we amend it.
Let me just give you a comparative example. Back when Gavin Newsom was governor of San Francisco, he became convinced that the Equal Protection Clause of the California Constitution and the federal constitution were being violated by the refusal to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And so what did he do? Did he defer to courts? Did he wait? No, he immediately started issuing marriage licenses in violation of law.
He started handing out things that he thought would get him votes.
And everyone applauded him for doing that. Now,
what is Trump doing? He's handing out things that he hopes will get him votes.
No, arguably, he's just as good as Newsom. He's convinced that there has been a misunderstanding and misinterpretation of this clause of the 14th Amendment, and he is therefore trying to do something about it. It's the same as Newsom, in my judgment. They're either equally politically craven or equally constitutional.
So there's a question.
Because of executive power.
So there's another question that we're slightly hasn't come into our attention that much. So is this just sort of an administrative law thing, and it's a kind of a technicality of process, or are individual rights of some sort in danger of being infringed? So we tend to have a universalistic view of individual rights. But somebody has to uphold them, okay? So the people that are going to uphold them are going to be the law enforcement on the ground in that area. And so
there's a mechanism of the courts, what they're going to do in this case.
Right. So to the discouragement of some, it might be the case that there are individual rights that people have that they're going to not be able to exercise because of one or the other way of interpreting this.
Yeah.
So some conservatives will say, well, that shows that classical liberals are just wrong. It can't be individual rights. It's only governmental mechanisms.
Conservatives don't say that.
One of the articles that I suggested that we all read says exactly that.
Okay, we're going to move on, but let's final count here. So is the Trump order on birthright citizenship a net positive or a net negative, Phil?
I'm very skeptical of it. And I'd add, in addition to everything that we've discussed, it entails Trump attempting to legislate by decree. So I think if there is a settlement of this question, at bare minimum, it needs to go through legislative action in Congress. It's not something that an executive order can just come in and decree by the day and reinterpret. And even that will be subject to a very long Supreme Court battle, basically, over the interpretation of these terms. So I think we're two steps away. One is Congress needs to actually act before this could even be pursued. And then the second would be, would the court uphold an interpretation along the lines of Trump? And I'm actually fairly skeptical that the current court would.
Bill, of course, negative or net positive, Bill?
Well, I'm troubled, but I do want to say in somewhat in response to Phil, suppose Congress does pass a statute. And then suppose the Supreme Court says, well, you've misinterpreted it. So it really goes back to the courts, I'm afraid. So, and I'm not opposed to, you know, the courts will show some deference toward Congress, but they're going to interpret it. And it's complicated. There, you know, it's in the Constitution, but so is, you know, gold and silver, okay? And yet the courts have just ignored
the power
that.
To declare wars. It belongs
yes,
in one
the
branch.
Power to declare wars. We haven't apparently been in any war since World War II.
So are you, were you net positive or net negative on this one?
I think I'm with the idea that just to show you another crazy thing that's going on. So one of Trump's orders, and many of them I agree with, of course, but one of them says that we have an invasion under the constitutional terminology of invasion. In other words, the people from Guatemala are troops of a country that is at war with us. This is not really right, okay?
No, that's
not. We are
not
at war with Guatemala, and we're not having an invasion from Guatemala or Colombia or Cuba or China or whatever. That's just not right. So there's been some hyperbole here that it would have been better off to restrain and pursue in other ways.
In general, I worry about the overuse of emergency powers.
Yeah, indeed. I think we should get to that.
Will in a minute. So, obviously, in my judgment, I think it's a net positive. Although,
I'm going to be what I almost never am. I'm going to be a weak shilly-shallier.
Well, one of the reasons for my thought on this is that presidents, like other parts of our constitutional leadership, have an obligation directly to the Constitution itself. Presidents have a privilege and a responsibility to interpret the Constitution in the course of their work. If I were Trump, I would have handled it differently. I would have said, this has been vastly misinterpreted for 100 years. Here's the right interpretation. I could just implement this by presidential decree,
He can ask the Solicitor General, ask the court.
Or he could say, I could do this, guys. I've got it right, but let me ask Congress to fix it first. That's what I think would have been a lot better.
Okay.
Next. We're going to turn to the question of another hot topic, DEI. So is President Trump finally going to slay the dragon of DEI, or was it already on the way to extinction?
Well, I think if the election had turned out in a very different way, we'd be talking right now about accelerating DEI. That was the trajectory of the Biden administration. So one of the interesting things here is how far is Trump going to go to weed out the DEI apparatus of the federal government? Where I find myself in agreement with him is defunding it, taking away the tax dollar support for what are basically just superfluous job programs attached to federal agencies to propagandize a variety of leftist doctrine.
So to that extent, the three of us are fine with this. It's like an inner office memo, an internal memo by the boss saying to his subordinates, we're not funding this. The company is not doing this anymore.
Right.
Now, there's additional stuff, though. All federal contractors.
Right.
So previously, under Obama and Biden and possibly earlier administrations, going back to Nixon maybe, we've had affirmative action creeping in to the private sector at the hint, or we won't get, we'll prefer people who have affirmative action, or you better have affirmative action, or we're going to punish you if you don't have affirmative action, or whatever it is. And then accompanying affirmative action has been the wokeness programs, the, you know, workplace training, which even at independent institutes you have to do if you're a supervisor, for various things, not particularly for race, but for various things. The point is, this is intermeddling in the private sector. Now, on the other hand, what if you are the good eats commune and you want to have some kind of,
of course, let them have
racial
their thing.
Mixture.
Let them have
but
it.
I
yeah.
want to sell to the next door Fort Ord military base.
Ah, well, that's different.
So then I can't have my.
You will be disadvantaged in selling to Fort Ord.
Oh, am I forbidden? Are you? Is Fort Ord going to reach in and say I can't have my multi-hued workforce?
Well, you can have it. You just can't sell to the government.
The federal
I guess
government.
That's what it means.
Okay, I think. You know,
is there a constitutional right to sell things to the government?
Freely? Okay, all right. So let's say I'm the Hoover Institution, and I get money from the federal government. They
Do
don't
they?
Get it for their scholars. They don't get it right. for their books. They get it for their special preservation of crackling, breaking documents.
Yeah, right.
Like, they have documents of the Russian Revolution or General Stilwell in the China Civil War, whatever. They have these books, and over time, they fall apart. So they get money from the government to do that. And, of course, Hoover's part of Stanford, which gets a zillion dollars.
Right, lots of money, right?
Well, right? That's the interesting implication is the university.
Now, let's say that Hoover, in some of his hiring, looks to have more people from underrepresented minorities or something like that. I'm not saying they do. I'm totally making this part up. But let's say they do. Go ahead, speak up, you guys.
Well, I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure, Bill.
Well, and this is back to the line that I keep drawing. I think the expenditure of tax dollars, it is entirely within the purview of the federal mm-hmm. government to say, no, you cannot spend tax dollars on mm-hmm. this stuff. It's ideological. It's a waste of money. I do get more concerned when the orders start to veer in the direction of specifically instructing private entities that you can or cannot have this type
and
of
you're,
consulting.
You're supposed to report if people are talking about DEI stuff.
Exactly. So it's the concern here is, does the pendulum swing too far
that
in the other direction?
Definitely the concern. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we're happy, but
yeah, this
but always vigilant and worried.
Yeah, I mean, the trouble with, as with so many things like this, when good policies are going to be implemented, the devil is in the details of how you enforce it. Okay,
so another person has pointed out that disparate impact is not affected by this at all. So let me explain to our viewers. Disparate impact means somebody does something, and it's neutral on its face, but it turns out that blacks are in some large measure affected differently from whites or Filipinos or whatever. Okay, so the federal government leaps in and says, you can't do this, this is discriminatory. But as Thomas Sowell, the great economist and scholar of ethnic issues, points out, well, okay, so there are a lot of Mohawks in the construction industry in New York City. So what? You know? And so, but that disparate impact, when I was in the federal government working in the Department of Education, the head of the Office of Civil Rights would periodically come in and say, to hold off the civil rights organizations, we do a certain number, some arbitrary number of disparate impact cases where we go after schools because of something where there's disparate impact. Most classical liberals would say, what? How can we have that as a standard of government action? And this is not still addressed. And this is, I think we would have to say, yes, the lingo of diversity is gone, but the deepest problematic thing is disparate impact, and nobody wants to bite the bullet on that.
Right. Yeah, it's like a third
Phil,
rail.
Phil, you agree?
Generally so, and this is going to be something that, like, the original disparate impact doctrine comes out of court interpretations of
so
the
Duke,
early...
Duke Power or something
the
like
Duke
that.
Power case, right. And this is the court's response to the earliest affirmative action and other similar policies that are enacted in the 60s. So it might take a further court interpretation of that before we settle the doctrine.
Let's talk about energy. My impression is that of all the sets of executive orders, this is the one I think I like the best, just unleashing energy production, and the federal government's no longer going to be insisting on incentivizing and advantaging wind production the way they have been. Am I right?
I'm going to raise a question. Of course, obviously, this huge promotion of wind production and the way that permits hold everything back, which is addressed in this, to encourage speed and certainty, and the electric car mandate and all this stuff is crazy, and it shouldn't be the policies. But underlying this is the claim that we have an emergency in energy. And as Dan Henninger said in the Wall Street Journal, well, if energy is an emergency, then anything and everything
is what is not an emergency right now.
Right? Because energy permeates everything. So while we could be happy about the policy changes, should have been done differently.
Again, should have been done differently, right? So the legal justification is invoking an emergency. That's the legal justification.
Yeah. And
that's the worry.
That's a problem.
It's a worry that we have government by emergency. Some
exactly
people in the past, I don't know, Cato, somebody did some horrifying compilation of all the existing emergencies that are supposedly. The thing is, somebody can make an emergency in 1935.
Yes,
and if it's never ended, it's still on.
Right.
You know, wheat production in Kansas in 1935. There's an emergency. All right.
Okay. Well, I will admit that you've quelled my enthusiasm a little bit for the energy one.
But they really did a lot of good things there. Okay.
Well, but this is related then, this emergency thing, to the freedom of speech order, which is pretty interesting, which seems to me to be triggered by the fact that the U.S. government was leaning on private companies to restrict freedom of speech on COVID-related issues in a lot of ways. And so no more of that. Now, that seems good. I mean, you yourself have some firsthand knowledge, Phil, of how the feds weighed in to limit what people could say about the pandemic,
Phil,
right?
Phil is a victim, and victims are the highest thing in American society.
No, that's right.
I am indeed a victim of what I call Fauciism, a victim of the entire COVID regime during the Great Barrington Declaration era. In fact, I found the Freedom of Information Act request that uncovered that now infamous email, where Francis Collins ordered Anthony Fauci to wage a devastating published takedown of the fringe epidemiologists.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw subsequent actions by the government through the Twitter files. Mark Zuckerberg just admitted basically the same thing.
In his interview with John Rogan. Also.
Yeah, right, he admitted that the federal agent, federal officials actually would swear and curse at him with obscenities because he was resisting their blandishments to censor.
Well, and the great issue here is, so the federal government is prohibited by the First Amendment from engaging in censorship on its own right. And what we saw in the Biden administration in really abusive ways is they start leaning on the public sector to do things that they are constitutionally prohibited from doing.
You mean the private sector?
The public sector leaning on the private sector.
Yeah, exactly. Started happening under Trump. It even happened under Trump.
Well,
it absolutely did.
You know, it's conceivable that Franklin Roosevelt leaned on some people. Woodrow Wilson or even Abraham Lincoln.
David Beto's book digs into quite a few of those things on FDR.
Well, Abraham Lincoln closed down newspapers he didn't like.
Yeah.
So
Alexander Hamilton pursued the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Alien and Sedition Acts.
It is a nasty tradition.
It's a temptation to these people in power.
So is
there's
this
another
a good
there's another borderline problem here, and that is it's important that the federal government or the state government or the local government can go to the news media and say, there's a crime. Here's what the criminal looks like. There's been a child abduction. Here's what we know about the child. The car was heading this way. We've discovered Ebola plague, and you should know about this. And they should be able to do that.
Absolutely.
There's a sexual...
The government does have its speech rights.
Right. That's right. And so the defenders...
It goes back to this whole
of the
movement.
Pressure and the coercion that was done against Phil and other like situated people is that the government says, oh, we were just using our speech rights we would to talk about a kidnapping.
We deemed it misinformation.
And misinformation and disinformation are what mislead the society, cause polarization, cause mistrust, cause ineffective response to crises, and therefore we're entitled to do whatever the hell we want to the media.
It's so wonderfully well-intentioned.
Well,
we
need to confine it to things like crimes and floods and things like that. I mean, you know, the government... Speaking as a Californian here, indeed a Southern Californian, their warning system doesn't even work.
Right, right.
They're supposed to. They not only sent thousands of false warnings out. I know people that had false warnings, but then in the middle of the night for the Altadena fire, the Eden fire, they didn't send it until the people were already burned up. And so anyway, that's the government and the media. They're not quite perfect yet.
So I think
the key thing to bear in mind is said by a man named Martin Guri on Reason. And he said, well, the believers in Bigfoot and the believers in Flat Earth are entitled to their freedom of expression. And the government doesn't have a right to shut them down.
Mm-hmm. So, Phil, based upon what you have both experienced and studied, do you think this free speech order is a net plus?
It's absolutely a net plus, and I just only hope that they actually adhere to the philosophy behind it.
Yeah,
so they're also, part of it is, they're supposed to dig back and see who did it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's part of the inquiry
we need to have.
If
appropriate, take legal action.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was it that brought up the question not long ago of a kind of a truth and reconciliation process to bring to the light what was hidden during those COVID years? I wonder if that could shed some light and maybe we'll learn some things that are...
But you see, once again, you're shilly-shallying, Graham, because the truth and reconciliation means we're going to just tell what happened, but we're not going to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the model of South Africa and so forth.
And the Czech Republic.
I am troubled by everybody litigating against the previous occupants of the government. On the other hand, maybe some of them did really egregious things. I hate to have this on the one hand. On the other hand, my inclination is if they seriously violated the law, feloniously violated the law, then they should be subject to the law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it really bothers me that a federal official decided to implement a takedown of my colleague, Philip Magnus, because his views were not the ones they favored. Something's wrong with that.
I know, but it's okay. It's problematic because that guy thought, oh, the president told me to do this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Moving on.
I was just following orders, said Adolf Eichmann.
Just following orders.
Right. Okay, so here's a bunch of other maybe things of less consequence or more, depends on your view. So, On day one, Trump in his inaugural speech said that from henceforth there's only be two genders, male and female. Later, the documents are a little more clear, only two sexes, male and female, which is a lot more precise than saying two genders. And then subsequently, there's been an executive order which forbids federal funding for so-called transitioning surgeries to essentially mutilate the bodies or the hormonal systems of children and teens. This seems like a pretty decisive shift. It's a really strong use of federal power, hinges on federal funding power. To me, it looks like a blow for sanity and for the well-being of children. What do you think, Phil?
I think the great question here is, where is the cutoff age of adulthood for making decisions?
Right.
And I think as a society, we've come together and said, when you turn 18,
yeah,
you attain adulthood. That's when you can vote. You gain certain rights that we deny to children for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea here is that you've reached maturity and being able to make a decision. Now, there are some things that are a little bit later, like 21 to drink. 25, I guess, is to rent a car now, to purchase a handgun's 21, for example. But these are decision points we've made in society to basically say that there's responsibility, that the individual making them has the knowledge and the breadth of understanding of the decision,
right?
That's the consequence. And I think 18 is actually a very perfectly reasonable.
It is reasonable, yeah.
Here.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, implied by that is if you're under 18, no, you cannot make that decision yet. But if you're over 18, you live with the consequences.
You live with the consequences, right?
And that's part of your freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So let me bring up two other flies in the ointment. So one is, we used to have, especially during the progressive era, but certainly didn't originate there. We used to have what was called women's protective legislation. So if you were a woman and you were working in a bakery, they limited the number of hours you could work, and they limited the hours of the day you could work in a way that did not limit men. Now, right now, that's illegal.
That's out. Mm-hmm.
Right? But there are only two sexes. Okay, so I can tell you that some of the Trump people that were interviewed for articles in relation to this said, well, we're partly doing this to protect women. Oh, in sports, yes. But if you can protect them in sports, why can't you protect them in bakeries? Okay, that's the question. We're not going to have time to answer any of these questions.
Well, I think
and the second question I have is this is a good thing. There was a Shawnee State University professor who was fired for not using the pronouns that one of his students wanted, preferred pronouns.
Yeah, there are lots of cases like that.
So presumably this would be overturned. This person would get his job back.
Right.
Well, and I think the legal reasoning behind it is, you know, if people underwent one of these medical procedures, they're basically irreversible. And someone under the age of 18, the notion here is they don't have the judgment and the capacity at that point. They haven't reached adulthood to make that decision.
Okay, so now let's go back to our Shawnee State professor. The student in front of him is over 18. And let's say he yesterday changed sexes, whether just outward appearance and hairstyling or whatever, or through surgery and hormones and so forth. Okay. And so the university says you have to address the person by the pronouns that that person prefers. Does this end that and retroactively revisit that or not? Because we're talking now about somebody who's after the age of 18.
There's a countervailing issue there, which is freedom of speech.
The speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of that comes down to there are questions of courtesy in play.
Sure.
And then for example.
You can't legislate courtesy.
You cannot legislate courtesy.
The problem is, Well, I mean, I don't know. A private university can certainly say if you're constantly discourteous to your students, you're out of here.
As long as they're not taking federal funds, let them do what they like.
That's almost nobody, as we know.
I know.
Well, there's a deeper problem there on how entrenched the federal government has become in the higher education system.
Which Phil has written
all the strings attached.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, we're bringing up some problems, so it's...
Yeah.
But we're happy about this.
Oh yeah, I think it's a huge gain for freedom and for just cultural sanity. I don't think the federal government needs to be in the position of corroding a culture and physical health. So let's talk about a comparison between the Biden pardons and the Trump pardons, which is something Phil is ready to talk about, I believe. It's an interesting comparison. And of course, they occurred so close in time to one another.
Yeah. So you have two issues at play here. First, so the Trump pardons that have come out, the largest batch by far, the January 6th protesters. And there's a mixture in there of an outright pardon, which wipes the record clean, and then the commutation of sentence, which is basically till time served. You're free to go. Mm-hmm. They are all specific to crimes that were committed in, as part of the riots on January 6th. I don't think anyone disagrees that there were acts of violence committed that day, and including prosecutable acts of violence. At the same time, some of the sentences tended to be very, very heavy-handed on those protesters vis-a-vis other circumstances. And I liken it back to the George Floyd protesters that burned down federal buildings in Portland, Oregon, that trashed other types of government property and either got off
of the
larger
number
at all.
A larger number of violent protesters.
Also, the January 6th people were held in solitary confinement for quite a long time, too.
Right. In a court system that does not seem to have been equipped to expeditiously handle the cases. So, in a sense, I think there is a matter of fairness here that a lot of the people that were caught up in that, time served was actually a pretty substantial punishment on them vis-a-vis the act of rioting, vis-a-vis the crime. So in that sense, Trump's actions do seem to be, erring on the side of an exercise of some justice there. I contrast that with some of the last minute Biden pardons, which were not particular to a specific crime. They are, here's mm-hmm. a blanket stamp of approval for anything Anthony Fauci did over the last 10 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or even worse, the one that he signed like 5 minutes before he left office named his brother and his cousin and his uncle and all the Biden family members, and basically said they gave him the Hunter Biden deal and said, we don't know if you committed any specific crimes, but here's your blanket pardon for anything
you
and
might
everything
have
done.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So it is really an apples to oranges situation. And I actually do think some of the J6 protesters deserved prison time, deserved prosecution for violent actions that they did. But that time has been served. Whereas a lot of the people that Biden pardoned, it's just like this abstract blanket piece of paper that's supposed to insulate them from anything and everything possible they could have done. And it's like, you determine, what if Anthony Fauci embezzled $10 million from the NIH in 2015? Is that covered under the pardon?
It's covered.
It's covered.
Yeah.
It's covered. But imagine, I don't know, let's imagine one of Hillary's half-brothers or one of Jimmy Carter's brothers or something did something. I mean, I don't think that it would have seemed pretty odd for them to get pardons.
It would have.
Now, when Trump leaves office, he's going to pardon his whole family.
You'd think so, yeah.
I would be surprised if he didn't.
It's a new norm, and I think it's a bad one.
It's certainly an incentive for the family to commit crimes.
It's like you have 4 years of a free pass, and then we're going to get rubber stamped.
Maybe you have going back 10 years of free pass.
Well, Hunter got a way back, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the video resurfaced.
No. Fauci also got a way back because they started doing some of this gain of function stuff way back.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. It's 2014 is the start date of the Wuhan lab investments that are coming out of the NIH. That's suspiciously similar to the date the Esper, the blanket pardon for.
Okay,
and
so
for Hunter, it's coincident with the beginning of the Burisma involvement.
Yeah. Okay, Phil, so I accept your comparison on the whole, but I do have a niggling worry. We always bring up niggling things toward the end of these segments. My niggling worry is that I was pretty impressed when, I think about 2 weeks before the pardons, before the inauguration, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance made a very public comment saying that, well, violent protesters shouldn't be pardoned. And I thought to myself, you know, that makes a lot of sense. Let's distinguish between the violent and the nonviolent. But then when Trump did it, he apparently disregarded what Vance had said.
Yeah, yeah.
Should I be worried about that? Or are you right to say that?
I think it's a valid worry. Okay. You know, I tend to agree with this, that the more violent actions on January 6th deserved commensurate punishments, commensurate sentences, whereas the people that just wandered in the Capitol dome for 15 minutes, that's a very, very minor offense versus one that like shoved a police officer. That's a more serious offense.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, I kind of liked that he didn't do whatever J.D. Vance said.
Well, maybe
because on some issues, we prefer the historic position of Trump to the historic position of J.D. Vance. On some other issues, we prefer Vance.
Maybe it's nice to have a little bit of independence between the two of them. After all, Vance is the only major federal executive branch official who can't be fired by Trump.
Basically. Yes.
That is a very good point. Although, something happened to Aaron Burr back then.
He may have gotten involved in a duel.
Well, I mean, I think he was tried for treason or something.
Yeah, he was.
I don't remember whether, I guess he was no longer vice president by that time.
At the end of our time here, but.
What about Greenland?
I say make Greenland great again, whatever that means.
Well, it seems to me the Greenland thing is something that Trump brought up during his first presidency and brought up a little bit in the campaign. Much more talk about it now. There's multiple issues. First of all, we have a base right now. I'm going to have to read off the name of it.
Thule Air Base.
It's a space base, right? Mm-hmm. And remember, during World War II, the U.S. just basically took over Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a situation where we have cooperation with Denmark, which is, after all, a member of NATO. So we could work out something with them to enhance Greenland's defense, I think.
Oh, it's
we're still more or less friendly to them.
We are already getting more or less what we want in need for our strategic interests out of Greenland.
Great resources they have, well, let's buy them, on the market. We can buy them just the way you buy anything else.
And freely trade with Denmark to get those resources. So this is what's so baffling about it, because if we were to take over Greenland, it's not just a net gain of we get some sort of strategic presence there. We also have to inherit the public expenditures to sustain Greenland.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of welfare that gets spent in Greenland. It's a huge expansion of our defense perimeter.
Yeah. So this is actually something that would cost probably quite a bit of taxpayer money to bring into the United States. And so why do that when we have essentially what we want and need right now through peaceful relations? And yet,
why do that when we could take over Canada and have the Quebec problem? Speak of the Inuit problem.
Enough said, I think. Of course, we have to admit that the Greenland thing does not involve an executive order. It's just a whatever. It's a foreign policy foray. On the whole, on executive orders, last thought here. I like a lot of the executive orders, as was obvious. But even the ones that I like, I do worry that it's a use of the executive order power that could push the presidency even further in the wrong direction of a consolidation of an imperial presidency. Is there any way to mollify my fear, Phil. Do you think Trump contains within himself already the sense of restraint against the imperial presidency, or do we have to count on the institutional obstacles that he will face?
I think we have a long 4 years of, at least on some of the more excessive actions, those institutions will need to step up. And that includes both Congress legislating and clarifying areas that it has dropped and abandoned its duty. But it also means that the courts are probably going to weigh in and impose some limits on the extent of executive power, especially unilateral executive power. Trump can maximize what the presidency can do in terms of discretion. But at the end of the day, sometimes he's going to have to go get statutory authorization for some of the things that he wants.
Yes. Let him seek statutory authorization. That's so healthy.
remember Obama saying, oh, I can't do the Dreamers. And then, you know,
then
I have to
go
to Congress. And then he just turned on a dime and did it.
This is not new to Trump. It's actually building on abuses
or to somewhat assuage your worries, Graham, which I share, and I share Phil's worries. A lot of this was undoing Trump thing. I mean, Trump undoing Biden things.
Yeah.
And so that is understandable.
Yeah,
but
it really is.
We don't really want someone who looks like a pre-Victorian English monarch. We want a Republican presiding executive, and it's, you know, hard to do, but it does mean that Congress is supposed to go through the difficult process of legislating.
Right.
The designers of the Constitution did not mean to have edicts and decrees easily issued from a monarchical figure. They meant a process of deliberation, consideration during a legislative process. If it's just something sent down from the throne on high, it's no longer constitutional.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the thing is that the Trump and those who support Trump, as much as they're optimistic now, they really can't count on retaining the presidency for another 8 years as they hope. I mean, it could be a reversal again. And then once again, all the powers that have been accumulated and exercised by Trump will be exercised in reverse once again. We need to get out of that cycle, I think.
Absolutely.
Thank you both so much for your interesting commentary. Thank you for agreeing and disagreeing with me and with one another. Thank you for our friends who have joined in on our conversation. We invite you to visit our website at independent.org, where we make a lot of these issues come to life with detail and careful analysis in the material we publish there. And of course, you can find other episodes of Independent Outlook available on our website. So join us next time for Independent Outlook. Thanks again, everybody. Take care.